You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is the day before Thanksgiving. As I speak now, or rather I should say, as you hear me now, I'm undoubtedly traveling to Worcester for the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. I'm looking back and I'm saying, Myla, please, just stop. Just stop kicking the stop it. No, I understand the car has automatic windows. It doesn't matter. Just please, just sit. No, we cannot stop. No more TikTok or Kit Kat or whatever. I'm tired of that song. We've heard it 5,000 times. Please stop it. Nikki, what? I'm just telling her to quiet. And we are heading back to Worcester to enjoy a wonderful Thanksgiving meal. But that doesn't mean that you don't get content. That's right. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the content from the 12-hour marathon. In this edition, you will be getting content from hours 2 to 5-ish. You know, look, folks, it's hard enough to actually do the thing, but to keep track of it, what do you want out of me? So, ladies and gentlemen, on today's podcast, you will hear the great Chris Hayes from Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. We talk about Occupy Wall Street, and then we get a very strange call from Senator Katherine Harris. It's actually Janine Garofalo. And she is a bizarre creature. Wonderful, delightful, but bizarre. A great show. Now, that's the free podcast. But if you're a member, you're going to be hearing a whole lot more than that. First up will be Mark Maron. We speak for almost 25 minutes and don't come to blows. Then Allison Kilkenny will give us an update on what's going on with Occupy Wall Street from that fateful Thursday. Then, of course, Chris Hayes from Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. We'll be talking to Senator Katherine Harris, really Janine Garofalo, and Marcos Melitzis of the Daily Kos. And then finally, we'll be talking to Mike Konzigal of the Roosevelt Institute. We talk about a lot of issues that are important to Occupy Wall Street. And we also get in at least one libertarian caller who calls in. I'm not going to say I handed it to him, although you should know this. The guy put up a YouTube saying I handed it to him. That's how much I handed it to him. So, folks, if you're on the roads, drive carefully. If you're heading home to visit family, travel safely. If you're getting ready, darning your socks and basting your turkey, whatever you do on Thanksgiving, do it well. Enjoy this podcast. And if you're a member, know that we have loaded up all of the next 3 days worth of podcasts, so you can download them now. And if you're a freeloader, well, you just have to wait till tomorrow. But you could also just go and join at majority.fm right now and become a member, and we'll be sure to send you your member information. Don't delay. All right, folks, enjoy.
presidents, we're all congressmen, we're all cops. And waiting were the workers of the world. There is the elite and the dispossessed, and it's only about survival. Who has skill to play the game for all?
In our fourth hour of our 12-hour show on the Majority Report, 1 year anniversary of the relaunch. It's the 2 month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. It's a day of action in New York City and, in fact, internationally. And it is a real pleasure to welcome to the program the host of my, I think, my favorite TV show. And I'm including Survivor in that.
What about Breaking Bad and, you know, all the.
I'm not a big Breaking Bad fan.
Friday Night Lights.
You know, no, I like Mad Men is off right now. Empire Boardwalk's okay.
We'll take it. We will take it.
Like literally, I'm talking all forms of television. Chris Hayes, the host of Up with Chris, the aptly named Up with Chris.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Sam.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming on. So. Pretty crazy.
Yeah, craziness. I mean, I'm trying to monitor. I didn't get a chance to go down there this morning just because Thursdays and Fridays are intense prep days for us with the show on Saturday and Sunday. But I'm going to try to get down to Foley Square, and I've been watching the live stream. You know, it's really something to see. I think one of the things I think that I've had a little bit of a evolution on was in the beginning – I think I thought that I didn't want to spend a lot of time covering the sort of, you know, clashes of the police or police misconduct or the harshness of the police response, because it felt to me like that was kind of a meta issue, mm-hmm. you know, and that I wanted to focus more squarely on the message of the 99%, the 1%, and that part of it. And I think I went through a period where I was like, oh, this whole thing is sort of becoming too much about these sort of clashes with police, etc. And now I've sort of come full circle and come to, or not full circle, 180 degrees, and come to recognize that in some ways, seeing the sort of amount of money and resources and harshness that the sort of defenders of the status quo, the state, will deploy to put down what has been from the beginning a fairly, I mean, incredibly nonviolent, but also kind of non-threatening movement. I mean, you know, there's a lot more messed up stuff you can do that would really grind the city to halt that no one is doing. And yet the amount of intense suppression that has been leveled at the protesters, not just in, you know, New York, obviously, but in Oakland and Seattle and in Boston, says something deep and profound about the desire to protect the status quo, the desire to sort of quash disruption. And to me, it's been really eye-opening.
You know, I've been saying something similar all day, and when I have, I hearken back to our conversation from a couple of weeks ago when you were talking about just how Occupy Wall Street has made us reimagine politics. And over the next couple of days, I think I was thinking about that, both in terms of how Occupy Wall Street just had sort of raised multiple issues, and even the act of occupation and in these instances reveal stuff about our society that had otherwise been dormant. You know, to extend and expand upon what you're saying is we are starting to see like what the implications of the Department of Homeland Security is,
right.
Where, you know, so much of this equipment has been bought under the name of Homeland Security and has not been used for Homeland Security. It's being used, or I guess not to protect Americans, but it's used against Americans.
Yeah.
And it's just that, just the projection of that in whether you're living in Dallas and you're watching it on your local news, or in Portland or in Seattle or in Oakland or in Boston or
– right.
I think it's got to have some type of profound effect on Americans.
I think it does. And I also think, I mean, I think what you're seeing also is in the public opinion data, and even just talking, like I was talking to people I know, my parents actually were over for dinner the other night and we were talking about it. And, you know, I think there is this, there's a little bit of a backlash I think that's inevitable, right? Which is that there's a desire to kind of return to normalcy. And I think even, you know, good liberals and people who are not okay with the status quo. At the same time, just at a personal level, like they want normalcy, they want order, and we saw those politics channeled very effectively, particularly by the right during the 1960s. You know, that was how Ronald Reagan, you know, became the governor of California, was promising essentially to restore order to Berkeley and to the California university system. And I think that there's a strong desire for a sort of return to normalcy, and I think the most powerful part of Occupy Wall Street is basically just saying we cannot accept normalcy. That normalcy is that the status quo is untenable and unsustainable and morally bankrupt. And so it is our duty to disrupt normalcy, to create an atmosphere of disruption that sort of serves as a constant reminder that normalcy is not okay. And that's going to be controversial and polarizing. I think, you know, people maybe in the beginning sort of convinced themselves that the 99%, 1% message was so inclusive that it would be kind of broadly popular. And, you know, we know the history of politics is that effective social movements are often not broadly popular. They're deeply polarizing. And, you know, they're polarizing precisely because they're pushing the boundaries, because they're acting as a kind of irritant, because they're dissenting from a status quo, which people feel generally invested in, even if they don't feel like they're sitting atop it. So, you know, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how Occupy Wall Street transitions to the next phase, not just without the sort of, you know, the tents and the tarps and the sleeping bags and the encampment in Zuccotti, but also in terms of what its sort of public profile is across the country.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering about the implications. I mean, I've seen, you know, the poll that just came out the other day that says their favorability ratings are down, and I wonder if that has, for instance, the same impact upon Occupy Wall Street as it would for the Tea Party, because the Tea Party, to a large extent, turned out to be very much an electoral movement. I mean, very in pretty early on. I mean, they were challenging Republican candidates specifically with a Tea Party brand. And I would imagine favorability is far more important when somebody actually has to go to a poll, an election booth, and pull a lever, as opposed to a movement that's out there. And even though there, you know, there may be a lack of favorability of what's going on, and I would attribute a lot of that from a lot of the bad press about what happened in terms of like the actual sort of like the making of the sausage, as it were, in actual parks.
Yep.
The narratives are actually gaining traction, it seems like.
I think those two are related, right? I actually think that sort of, you know, poll tested bland messaging, you know, might be more popular, but it's not going to push the conversation. And so what you're seeing is this language is pushing the conversation, even if it's coming at the same time that the actual movement as such has sort of declined in popularity. And remember, the Tea Party started out very popular. People were like, well, yeah, I think the system is terrible, and you know, I didn't like the bailout, and maybe we're spending too much money. It seems like we're spending a lot of money, and things are screwed up. And then, you know, it became very unpopular. It became very polarizing. But that did not stop it from being very effective politically. I mean, the point is that the power was channeled into electoral forms, but also they kept up, and they kept at it, they kept organized, and I don't think it bothers Tea Party organizers that, you know, Tea Party favorability is 20-25%, because they matter a lot. They have leverage over the House Republican caucus primarily, and the House Republican caucus, you know, comprises one half of one third of the government.
I want to talk to you about, you know, one of the things that, you know, I watch your program every weekend, and there's one exchange that it really stuck in my craw. I want to talk to you about this because you're also one of the most knowledgeable people I know when it comes to wonkiness, with a capacity to explain it to people who aren't as knowledgeable. Tim Carney keeps claiming that student loans. Tim Carney is a guy that I'm on Radigan with occasionally, well, every Monday, and an avowed libertarian, although I think that's just a matter of time.
before that collapses on him. But and I've told him. He claims that student loans have driven up the price of college. And I'm curious as to – I understand the theory behind this. Mm-hmm. But, in fact, we've seen cutbacks on student loans and Pell Grants over the past 5-10 years. College prices continue to increase. And where we don't see student loans offered or grants by the government, we see private lenders step in. Mm-hmm. Right. Student loans are one of the few loans that you cannot get rid of in a bankruptcy proceeding.
Yep.
So isn't this really a problem with the free market?
Well, so I think there's – I guess I would separate out two things. I don't – I've – you know, there's a pretty – you know, tuition costs for universities particularly have been going up even faster than healthcare, right? And so it's a locus of tremendous inflation. In fact, during the housing boom years, the three costs that were going up the most were the three pillars of middle class life: health insurance, housing, and college. Right? Those are the three things you want to kind of like be able to give your family, right, to sort of achieve this sort of middle class stability. And those were the places, while the rest of the consumer price index, or the rest of prices in the country were not going up very rapidly, those three were. The housing boom obviously has changed that in terms of housing, but student tuitions continue to go up at a pace that far outpaces inflation, and it's really problematic. Now, there's a robust literature on what is causing that, and there is a bunch of different theories about it. I don't think my sort of familiarity with the literature, such as it is, doesn't suggest that student loans are the triggering thing, because obviously student loans have been in place for a long time, and it's very hard to make the case that their expansion has been the cause of the rise in tuition as opposed to the effect of more and more people going to college. That said, so I don't think broadly you can make the case, and you can make the case, but I don't think it's a very plausible one. The place where I think Carney has a point, actually, is in the development of this market in the for-profit colleges, which have essentially used the government's backing of student loans as a means of essentially extracting the money from the loans and sort of throwing the student by the wayside. So what you have are colleges that are set up in such a way to recruit students and essentially just get the college's hands on the student's federally subsidized loan money. And then, you know, who knows if the student learns anything or ever graduates, but they've got the money in their pocket. And then if the student drops out, they, that's too bad. They still have gotten their $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is. The way to solve that, I think, is not to get rid of student loan guarantees. I mean, the way to solve it, right, is to put into place some regulation on this. And in fact, the Department of Education, to their credit, has started to put in regulation. They had very forceful language that was, of course, watered down, as the process always works this way. But they've promulgated some regulations that basically looks at default rates at for-profit universities. And if the default rates are above a certain threshold, then the students who go to the school cannot qualify for federally subsidized loans. And this is a way of making sure that these enterprises are not just set up as essentially con jobs to sort of shepherd federal dollars into the coffers, students be damned. But I do think there's a much more plausible sort of libertarian story or story to be told about the kind of nexus of kind of government subsidized credit and rent seeking in that specific market.
Now, is there do you have a sense of what the division is between private student loans and ones that are either subsidized by the government or backed by the government?
I don't. I mean, it tends to go in tranches. So the first thing that people do is get subsidized student loans, and then after that, they get unsubsidized private loans. And I know, you know, that's what my wife did with college, and that's what I did for undergrad. I do know that what has been radically increasing, I mean, increasing an insane amount, is private for-profit educational college institutions. They've been growing. Not only have they been growing in terms of the percentage of students they educate in college, but their returns are just completely unsustainable. In fact, I've gone through a PowerPoint that's circulated around by a famous investor who shorted the housing market, basically saying this is the same kind of bubble, that this the way that this system is set up cannot be sustained.
And wouldn't the answer just be to go back to a more robust system of free education?
Right. I mean, that's exactly the point, right? Like,
supposedly we're wasting all this government money by backstopping these loans that never get paid. Why don't we just use that money to give people the free education that they used to have through the state system?
Right. I mean, that's precisely, I think, the point. And I think it's a perfect example of the ways in which our policy vision has grown so cramped that we don't think about sort of broad universal public benefits in the same way that we used to. I mean, we think about, all you have to do is compare Medicare to the Affordable Care Act for sort of a glimpse of what that looks
right?
I mean, you have this sort of jerry-rigged kind of public-private way of sort of trying to create government incentives and subsidies and the sort of a kind of network of nudges that get you to where you want to be policy-wise, because it's politically untenable to just say we're going to create a new universal public benefit, for instance, for your universal public college, and we're going to pay for it, and it's going to cost essentially a nominal fee. And that was the vision that created the state university system in a lot of places that have been remarkably successful and were a key feature, particularly, I think, in the state of California, a key feature of producing upward mobility and a strong middle class. And so I think the current system is probably not – something's got to give. I mean, I think it's broken in a whole lot of different ways. College students are not getting the we've essentially seen a plateau in the percentage of the population that gets a four-year college degree. More and more people are going to college, but not as many, but no more people are coming out on the other end. So we have this huge.
Do you think that's a function of?
I don't know. There's a really interesting debate happening across and within different ideological lines about American higher education, its future. There's a huge review essay in the New York Review of Books that I just read, and there's a lot of different kind of ideas, and it actually gets into some interesting ideological cross currents. There's sort of a movement on the right to basically say college education is not as valuable as we may think it is, but then there's also a movement, I think, to say that colleges should have some sort of accountability, sort of taking some of the models that school reformers talk about at the K through 12 level and applying it to colleges, which of course is anathema, I think, to academics who view their role very differently. But then there's also seems to be a case to be made that a lot of colleges aren't doing a great job of actually educating the people that they get inside their doors because they're not getting them to the four-year degree. So there's something that is, I think, broken. I don't know. It's not something that I have sort of enough command of to sort of figure out where I come down in this sort of brewing debate. But it's a really fascinating one, and there's a lot of interesting conversation happening about what the sort of present and future of American higher education looks like. And it's an important question to answer for a whole lot of obvious reasons.
Right. I mean, do we really want the guy giving us the hamburgers at McDonald's to really know that much about French literature?
Right, exactly. And part of it also, right, you say that facetiously, but it's also the case that there's, there's this problem with a job market like this in which people do graduate with degrees from four liberal arts colleges and can't get jobs
but the real problem is ultimately that they've spent the money on it. I mean, I don't think at the end of the day we have this problem of unemployment. It cuts across socioeconomic lines. It's also much better for you if you're college educated, but in terms of how bad it is. But at the end of the day, if you're not saddled with tens of thousands of dollars of debt that you cannot relinquish in the way that Donald Trump did today when he went bankrupt in one of his divisions, for building a casino somewhere or whatever it is. But merely for going to college, you still are theoretically a better citizen, capable of more potential, because of your education down the road. We can't pick and choose.
Right.
You should go to college because you're the one who's going to invent the thing that's going to help, the cure cancer.
Right. I mean, I think the point is that you want an educated populace for a million different reasons, both economically, because you want to develop human capital, and also in terms of, you know, democratic participation and citizenship and an active and vibrant society. You know, you want education. You want education broadly distributed, and you want access to it to be universal across class lines and lines of privilege. And, you know, that isn't what we have right now. I mean, at all. You know, we have an education system that, as you know, this is an obvious point to note, but does a lot more to reinforce, you know, privilege and class divisions than it does to break it down. And there's a lot of different ways to think about why that is. But I think one of the things you're seeing in terms of the diminution of kind of universities as a kind of public good is what's happening in a place like California, where, mm-hmm. you know, that's where austerity cuts go first. That's always been the case. It happens abroad. Student tuition fees in London under the coalition government led by David Cameron have gone up. In California, the Board of Regents, I think, had a 21% increase year over year over the last year, and is considering a plan now that would be 80% tuition hikes over 4 years. You know, that system is a system that educates a lot of poor working class people, first generation Americans, you know, and those kind of tuition hikes really start to price people out. And so you have a real perverse kind of eating your seed corn situation, right, where the massive financial crisis and the debt that built up in the system, the shenanigans and fraud, the deregulation, produce a hole in the public balance sheet. It destroys tax revenue. It creates mass unemployment. And then the hole in the public balance sheet is essentially the way to balance it is to go after public services, among them and chiefly education, which is the way that you essentially create the next generation of citizens and workers. And there's something really perverse about it. I mean, perverse not just in the fact that we're putting more debt on the shoulders of people, of students who are graduating, than ever before in the history of the republic. Perverse also in the sense that we are cutting off and constricting and choking their life possibilities because of the crisis now, with no vision for what or discussion about what that will mean for the country 20 years from now.
Right. We're hacking away at the foundation of our future in both on an individual and a macro scale. Well, Chris Hayes, I appreciate your taking the time. I know you're in prep for your show this weekend. And the student stuff, obviously a big part of Occupy Wall Street, and just the guy to answer that question. I knew it.
I love Majority Report, and I think it's indispensable, and I just am so happy that it continues to be on the air.
Well, thank you, Chris Hayes. I appreciate it. We got to take a break, folks. We'll be right back, and we'll take your calls.
If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees.
Well, listen, I got to jump, but listen, call back, because I got to take this caller. I'm sorry, but I appreciate it.
You got it. I'll be in touch.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Hello?
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 I'm sorry. Hello?
Hello, Samuel.
What?
Samuel.
Where are you calling from? Is this a 305 area? Who is this?
It's Kathy.
Oh, Catherine Harris.
It's Kathy.
Kathy Harris, former congresswoman from Florida, the famed Secretary of State during the Bush v. Gore recount, the one who never became senator. Oh, it's wonderful.
I was a senator. Yes, you're right. Senator Catherine Harris.
No, I don't. Well, let's not get into that argument about the. Are you sure you went? Did you
first of all, I'm so happy that you're celebrating Marc Maron's success. That's so wonderful.
I know. It's
that you would be celebrating, doing a marathon show to celebrate his podcast, award-winning, and that he is the sixth sexiest man on Salon. That's kudos to you both.
Actually, I don't. I think you're slightly confused. I'm not. I'm celebrating that it's the 1 year anniversary of the Majority Report, and we've got the 2 month anniversary of Occupy. I didn't even, to be honest with you, I didn't even hear about the salon, the sexiest, the sixth sexiest man.
He's wonderful. Mark is wonderful. Mm. And also, you know, you must be familiar with the Joseph the Plumber's podcast. Although he was robbed. Best Produced went to Inside the Magic. It should have gone to Joseph the Plumber's podcast.
I had no idea that you followed the podcast awards so closely.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, Marcus is a big one for it. She is always, he voted over and over again for Splendid Table, and it won for Food and Drink.
I'm sorry, Marcus, you're saying that Marcus Bachman, what?
He's a big fan of podcasts, and he loves Splendid Table. It won for Best Food and Drink.
I didn't know that. You know, I'm actually very happy to hear from you, Catherine, because there's so much going on in the Republican race. It seems, you know, the last time we spoke, I think Michelle Bachman was up in the polls.
Michelle, my belle. Yeah, but, you know, sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. But she's with me today at our day of action. We're having a day of action today at a paintball facility in Huntsville, Texas. It's wonderful. We're having a day of celebration, praise him, white power, and just celebrating the Tea Party values, white power, praise him, at a paintball facility in Huntsville, Texas.
So you're doing, what is the action that you're doing at the paintball facility?
Well, what aren't we doing is the first thing. We're having fun, you know, as always, we have our funnel cake. Oh, excuse me. I'm choking on a piece of funnel cake. Oh, my goodness. That stuff will get stuck in your throat. But anyway. Oh, and you know what? Congratulate. Chris Rosen is wonderful.
Wait a second. Before we move on to Chris Rosen.
I forgot to mention how much Chris Rosen adds to your podcast. I think you would have won an award or something if Chris Rosen had more.
No, wait a second.
But congratulations to Mark Maron.
No, wait a minute. First of all, we actually won Best Politics and News Podcast Award from Podcast. I'm surprised with your almost near encyclopedic knowledge of the podcast awards that you didn't know that we had won that.
No, I thought that went to the Mormon Faircast.
Not the Mormon Faircast, no. But I want to hear about why are you guys having a day of action eating funnel cakes?
I'll tell you what, and Victoria Jackson's going to be here. It's going to be wonderful. Victoria Jackson's going to be here. It's just a wonderful day of action. There's also going to be simultaneous days at Dollywood and Branson and other paintball facilities in the South and the Bible Belt. It's going to be wonderful. But here's what we won't be doing, Sam. Because this is important. I want to get to this. We won't be having all the defecation in the streets that the occupiers of your ilk have been just defecate. All the allegations of defecation, all the hearsay, it just doesn't pass the smell test, Sam. It doesn't pass the smell test. Mayor Bloomberg, he'll be the first to tell you, he will not tolerate even the whiff of controversy. And I'll tell you what separates the Tea Party from all of you grunge type street defecators is that, as you know, about 90%. Oh, this is a bad connection. What's going on?
No, you sound great to us on our end.
Well, you sound terrible. You sound terrible to me. You sound unwashed.
Well,
personal hygiene is important, Sam. Don't forget that.
I've been here for almost almost 5 hours. Believe me, my personal hygiene is really beginning to bottom out. I can almost smell myself, but don't let that distract you in any way.
I'm going to continue. Let me tell you what separates one of the main things, the Tea Party Nation, from the grunge movement on Wall Street is, first of all, as you may or may not know, about 90% of the Tea Party Nation has no indoor plumbing. So they're no strangers to outdoor defecation. Excuse me, more funnel cake. So, you know, they defecate outside a large percent of the time, but what they have are adult diapers that they wear, made in the USA, adult diapers. They don't go to a rally or an anti-tax celebration or any of those things. They do not leave home without a gun or a diaper. Any Tea Partier worth their salt will tell you that. Have gun and diaper, will travel. Get the government out of my diaper. That's the rallying cry. Get the government out of my diaper, Sam.
All right. I've sort of
it's
lost
like riding a bike. It's second nature defecating out of doors, you know, whether they're at a Red Lobster or a Family Dollar store in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, NASCAR, or a clog step dancing in the Hill Country competition. They have a big boy or big girl pull-up diaper. So that they don't have to have these allegations of defecating on Wall Street. It's just disrespectful.
All right. Well, okay. So that's fair enough. So the point is that if the Occupy Wall Street protesters had any respect, you're suggesting they would do.
And if they weren't so anti-Semitic, arsonists, anti-Semites. I mean, Yul Brynner would slap their face, not to mention Bibi and Sarah Netanyahu, if they could see this.
Well, you realize Yul Brynner, we've talked about this.
He's wonderful. No, oh, my goodness, Yul Brynner. Now, there's a real man. He's wonderful. Oh, and you know what else about the podcast? Joseph the Plumber's another problem that he had, which was so unfair. Apparently, you know, Joseph the Plumber's phrase that he would use a lot on his podcast was, get her done, meaning get Nancy Pelosi out of here. Get her done. And apparently, there's some mentally challenged individual named Larry the Cable guy who says get her done. He's a special needs performer, Larry the Cable Guy, but his lawyer, I believe his lawyer's name is Mooney B, he called Joseph the Plumber and said, you must pay every time you say get her done. And so he had to even pay retroactively. That's a lot of money. So
I didn't hear that. That's stunning.
Yes.
How much money did he have to pay, do you know?
Oh, you know, it was terrible, Sam. He wound up having to rob Peter to pay Paul, to pay Larry. It was so much money. And so he had to do a lot of extra work with his cover band, Freedom Tower. He's in that cover band.
Wait a second, Joe the Plumber has a band?
It's a cover band called Freedom Tower.
Who are they covering? Is there an original?
They do a lot of patriotic songs.
Oh, okay.
They used to be called Night Moves. They were a Bob Seger cover band, but now they go by Freedom Tower.
Wait a second. Okay, so we have really gone astray from what I really wanted to know is your take on the right now. Newt Gingrich is up in the pool.
Newton. Oh, what a historian. He's a wonderful historian. He really is something. Newton is a font of knowledge. He has a revolving account, not only at Tiffany's, but also with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And, you know, as you know, it's the Community Reinvestment Act that is the problem with the housing bubble that burst.
Well, I actually take exception to that, but
of course you do. big surprise there. It's a big surprise. It's about as surprising as a defecator in the financial district. The allegation of fame just doesn't pass the smell test.
All right. So let me, for the sake of argument, we'll grant that. But so do you think this is going to last with Newt? I mean, do you think this is actually – is he the real deal finally? They found a candidate who is going to save the Republican Party for having to vote for Mitt Romney?
Is he the real deal? Of course he is. Newton is a big thinker of big ideas. He's a big man. You know, he has gout. Much like our plus-size governor, Chris Christie of New Jersey. The two of them share that, you know, gout. They have high uric acid.
I didn't know that.
To elevate their foot because it really makes your big toe swells up when you have high uric acid when you have gout.
My understanding is that gout is very painful.
Oh, sure. It's one of those old-timey ailments that, you know, like the bloody flux or the vapors or bile chanting, stuff like that. But anyway, also Dylan Radigan, you're on with I love him, he's my crush, Timothy. You're on there with Timothy.
Tim Carney, I actually just...
Oh, he's wonderful. He's wonderful. And, you know, he's quite right. Student loans and Pell Grants are driving up the price of gas and movie tickets. This just through the roof. You can't wait by the time you pay a sitter and drive into the city with student loans and the Pell Grants. You can't see a movie. And have you ever, you know how much Raisinets cost? At the concession?
No, but
Pell Grants.
I mean, to be fair, I don't think that's his argument. Maybe I've misinterpreted it.
I'm sure you have, but you know who's classy? Imogen Lloyd Webber. Oh, what class. She's like that Pippa or Kate Middleton. Oh, Pippa, remember the wedding? And I got myself one of those rings like Kate Middleton has from the Sterlington collection. Oh,
wonderful. Who's Kate Middleton?
Who's Kate Middleton? Who's Kate? Did you hear that? Michelle. Oh, she's busy.
Oh, she's the one who married Prince William.
Sam, now you're just trying to get my goat. Now that's an act of aggression, just like linking arms. When college students link arms, you're trying to provoke me. When you link an arm as a college student, that's an act of aggression, and you're going to get a nudge in the spleen by the police department. Just a nudge in the spleen.
Well, listen.
That's a fine how do you do. And do you know how they make the law enforcement officials angry? Do you know what they're doing?
No.
Ray Kelly has a program where he shows them a picture of Mitch McConnell. They see red. It's like waving red in front of a bull.
The police don't like the picture of me. Well, listen, Catherine Harris, I can't thank you enough for calling in, but I've got to move on to another.
What? I'm calling you back later then, because we've got to talk more about Dilligan's Island.
Okay.
Dylan Radigan.
Happy to.
Dilligan's Island. Oh my gosh, a 3-hour tour. They had so many clothes. Anyway, Sam.
They had so many. Well, Catherine Harris, the former senator, congresswoman,
Senator, and remember, we are a nation of men, not of laws. That's what I want to leave you with. We are a nation of men.
That's how the saying goes. I don't think.
Praise him, white power.
All right, folks, we got to. Wow.
Satan, I built